Good morning. This is Scott Walter, monitoring coordinator for the Valley Stewardship Network. And I'm sitting here in the WDRT studios this morning, just a short walk down from our VSN offices on Main Street here in Viroqua, with a couple very special guests who I'll introduce in a moment. And we'll be discussing, I think, for folks that live in, enjoy, recreate, and perhaps own land in the Driftless, a topic of real interest, land use change in the Driftless area. And with me this morning, to my left, is Brandon Bluer. Brandon has a background in forestry, but currently serves as the director of the Department of Natural Resources for the Ho-Chunk Nation. Brandon, you want to introduce yourself briefly?
Yeah, as Scott stated, I'm Brandon Bluer, the executive director of the Ho-Chunk Nation Department of Natural Resources. The Ho-Chunk Nation DNR is responsible for managing the natural resources on all the nation's owned properties. That covers 15 counties in Wisconsin and some land base in Minnesota, and then a few small parcels in Illinois. And the nation has about 1,200 acres within the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. We spend a lot of management down on that property, and one of the things we'll be talking about today a little bit.
Very good. Thanks, Brandon. And then to my right, we've got a legend in the Driftless area, Maggie Jones, who's worked for years on natural resource conservation and educational programming. So welcome, Maggie.
I'm so happy to be here. I have a podcast on WDRT that airs on Tuesday mornings around 8:30. I follow the wonderful Laura Erickson and talk about natural wonders. And so this is a real honor for me to be asked to be here today, because I absolutely love this area, and I'm so anxious to have everybody understand it and love it too.
Well, welcome to both of you. I'm excited to have you here, especially as we get into this topic, thinking about the Valley Stewardship Network mission statement to protect our land and waters through research, education, and supporting community empowerment. The educational piece here, I think, today is key. And what we're going to be discussing as we move through our time together is land use change in the Driftless. And when I started to think about this topic, diversity is, of course, a buzzword you hear often in natural resource management, but we tend to think of diversity spatially, right? Like diversity in the plant community from one place to another. But in the Driftless, we've also got diversity prominent in a temporal sense. The history of what has happened in these hills is just fantastically interesting. So I think, again, anybody that's interested in, lives in the Driftless, spends time in the hills, understanding conservation in terms of the broader time scale, what was here prior to settlement, what were the impacts when the landscape began to be converted to primarily agricultural uses, and what legacy that has left us with on the conservation front in terms of the work we try to do out on the landscape. I think it's interesting. So one question maybe we could start out with is, prior to settlement, when no Europeans anyway were here, how do we know what was here? And Brandon, maybe you could talk briefly about the original land survey and what information we gleaned with respect to the pre-settlement vegetation of the Driftless.
Yeah, so a lot of the, you know, it was kind of a mosaic type of habitat, you know, kind of patchwork of, you know, primarily oak savanna and prairie sections in there, because a lot of this land was being influenced by large fires that were going throughout the landscape. And, you know, I kind of usually picture it as, you know, a lot of your, because there's a lot of topography in this area, so your more upland type sites were that prairie, oak savanna dominated. And then when you get down into the valleys, lower areas would be that more northern hardwoods, maple basswood type, especially along, you know, your river corridors and stream corridors. So, the big influence of fire was one of the biggest things that dictated that forest type that we were seeing back then. And
I think the word you use, mosaic, really wraps up what the Driftless looked like prior to settlement very well, this sort of interwoven patchwork of different habitat types, land covers, that arose in response to the randomness of fires that swept across the landscape. And the interesting thing regarding that picture is how it arose. The surveyors, who were the first Europeans really to set foot in this part of the state, used marker trees to define the boundaries of sections and townships, things like that. And it's reviewing their notes that gave us, an idea whether or not a particular piece of ground was dominated by oak or maple or prairie, what have you. So when we think about the Driftless prior to European settlement, one of the fact that there was native vegetation from horizon to horizon served a number of ecological goals. The intact vegetation held the soil in place. Nowadays, when we think about, for example, the Kickapoo River, the first word that comes to people's minds often is floods, right? Flooding. But prior to settlement, it's believed that those floods weren't very common because we had this very protective layer of vegetation, as Brandon suggested, prairies, forests of different types, holding that soil in place. So on the ridges, we had to develop a very deep, rich organic layer that acted like a sponge, right? Holding that soil in place and allowing the water to infiltrate, replenishing our groundwater stores and enriching the health of our streams. So prior to European settlement, a very healthy, wild landscape replete with wildlife species that might boggle some people's minds to know existed here. Passenger pigeons, as the owner of a seven-generation family farm, I sometimes think what my initial ancestor who set foot on our farm would have experienced, but certainly flocks of passenger pigeons in the mid-1800s weren't uncommon in the area. Elk, cougar, wolves, just a very wild community dependent on that landscape. Any other thoughts about the...
I wanted to bring up the fact that the beaver dams would have been a huge impact of slowing down the flow of water, as well as the soils that were held in place by the native vegetation. And the evolution of trout and beavers together here in the Driftless area, I always like to plug beaver dams. I love beavers.
Yeah.
They do a lot of good for us, creating wetlands.
Creating wetlands and adding to that diversity that I think is so important in the natural world.
Yeah, and I think one thing, too, I kind of wanted to reiterate a little bit is that, like I touched on earlier, that patchwork mosaic kind of habitat types or forest types that were there, because nowadays in like traditional forestry management, a lot of thought is put on managing at a stand level, which is more of kind of a label that's put on different forest types based on, an oak type, and then we got our maple type and northern hardwoods and everything like that, where I picture a lot more of an interspersion of habitat types that was going on due to that steady fire regime being on the landscape, rather than these kind of, in my mind, arbitrary blocks of forest units that are being managed that way.
So nature didn't recognize property boundaries the same way we do.
No.
Yeah. Well, it may be a couple of references for folks that are interested in what the Driftless looked like way back when. The map that's been developed from those original surveyors' notes is available online. If you just type in pre-settlement vegetation of Wisconsin, you can see what the pre-settlement vegetation types were in your area, even, you know, where your land or your farm may lie. And the original surveyor's notes have also been digitized and are available. So you can see the notes taken by the people that were walking across your land and setting section posts, et cetera, back in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. So
I encourage people to look up those original surveyor's notes. It's real handy to have a plat book, if you have a plat book, or know the section in the town. What are those parameters that they're helpful to know when you're looking up your specific land?
That's right.
Range, section, township, that kind of information will get you right to where those surveyor's notes are. And all you have to Google is Wisconsin original surveyor's notes. And you see them in their own handwriting.
Yeah.
It's really great.
They're, of course, most of their notes have to do with those marker trees. But one quick nugget I'll share related to what Maggie's talking about. When I was looking at the surveyor notes, William Burroughs was the surveyor who first surveyed the section that our farm lies in. And at one point when he was in the area, a messenger rode in and said he had to rush to Fort Prairie du Chien because Black Hawk was on the way through the Driftless, and they were trying to get all the surveyors to safety at Fort Prairie du Chien. So a little, interesting little nuggets like that. So
there's also an interesting book, if you can get a hold of it, called The History of Richland and Crawford Counties, which was published, I think, by the Richland Library years ago. I'm not sure who did it initially. It was republished probably 30 years ago by the people at the Richland Center Library, the Brewer Library. And you can read old letters for instance, on our farm, we know that one of the branches of the army that was chasing Black Hawk came along W down in Crawford County, just north of Boscobel, and came along that ridge and made their way towards the Kickapoo. And there's a lot of different history that can be found. It's wonderful.
Yeah, all those little tidbits add flavor to these hills.
Yeah, make you realize how recent we all are.
Yep.
And how there was so much that happened before we got here.
So you're listening to Valley Stewardship Network's Conservation Connection Show on 91.9 WDRT. I'm Scott Walter, and with me today is Brandon Bluer and Maggie Jones, and we're continuing to discuss land use change here in the Driftless. So given what we know about what was here prior to settlement, is conservation-minded folks or folks that enjoy the landscape here in the Driftless, it's really important to understand what changes took place to these hills and valleys. Once in the mid-1800s, we started to see the incursion of settlers primarily bent on converting that landscape to agricultural uses. So there were obviously some dramatic changes that took place, and it's important to understand those changes because primarily that's what we're addressing now with our conservation programs and focused conservation activities. But you can see, you know, the way the landscape was converted very readily anytime you set foot out on the landscape. If you were to drive down any road in the Driftless and step off into the woods, at some point you'd be stepping over an old barbed wire fence or woven wire fence that was used to hold cattle on the hillside pastures, because, you know, from top to bottom, east to west, the story of that conversion to agriculture in the Driftless was flat ground was cleared of its native vegetation, its prairie, its woodland, and converted to cropland. And the hillsides were fenced off and used to pasture livestock. And I think that had a very dramatic impact, certainly, on the vegetation community, but also the soil and water resources, and have left a legacy that we're dealing with, I think, yet today.
I think now one of our biggest challenges is the water rushing off these hills and the flooding and the movement of soils from the ridges down into the valleys. You were talking about David Trano did a cores of the valley soils. And what did you find? What did he find?
Yeah, I'll never forget. So David Trano was a longtime fisheries biologist for the DNR. And we were out in the field one day, and he was talking about early in his career, he had done a bunch of soil coring in valleys across the Driftless, as I recall, and he found that every valley was covered in from 7 to 18 feet of sediment that had washed off the hills really in the last century, since the hills had been stripped of that protective vegetative cover. So when you think about, you know, stream ecology, the health of our aquatic systems, and a lot of the work we do today, it's intended to repair the damage or address the issues related to sedimentation as the hillside soils and hilltop soils eroded into the valleys.
That's one of the things I've learned from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association's director, Tracy Hames. He always uses the phrase reconnecting the streams with their floodplains. And if you think about these deeply incised streams that we're so used to seeing with these incredibly steep banks of mud and soil, and what a challenge to think about raising up the stream so that when it floods, it doesn't take much to spread it out across the landscape. That's one of our big challenges, I think. And I think that's where beavers or beaver dam analogs, as people talk about, can help us think through how we can change the path of soil going downhill all the time. Slow it down, slow down the water.
That's right. And it, you know, it's interesting to think when you understand that those soils, which are now in our valleys, had been the sponge underneath the prairies or forests up on the ridge that was soaking up all that precipitation, the rainwater, and historically preventing large floods. But once we lost that sponge on the ridge tops and hills, now floods are something, of course, folks that live here have to deal with, unfortunately, pretty frequently.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Brandon, in terms of forestry, that nice patchwork or mosaic that wildfires sort of randomly spread across the landscape prior to settlement, you know, our forests were impacted greatly by the activities of our early settlers. Could you talk about that just a bit?
Yeah, I mean, there was, you know, big cutover events that were going on. Of course, trees were being harvested for consumptive use, cabin building, all kinds of uses. But then, you know, grazing impacts, you know, you're seeing the different soil compaction from that going on, land being cleared for grazing and agricultural purposes. And then, like, that losing that prairie component in there, I think, was just really detrimental to the area, because you have those prairie systems that have just root systems that are multiple feet deep and just holding in that soil so well. Just that loss was huge.
Yeah. And of course, the wildlife community responded to the activities of our ancestors here in the hills. We, of course, lost the large carnivores, the prairie chickens, which existed throughout this country, wild turkeys were driven extinct via hunting and market hunting. Even, and this is amazing to me, white-tailed deer were nearly driven extinct across southern Wisconsin. And I know this personally. My grandfather, who was born in 1903 on our farm near Viola, never saw a deer until 1954. He called my father and was so excited he had seen a deer down by the spring. So it that reflects, you know, decades of market hunting and unregulated hunting prior to the era of wildlife management or being concerned about sustainability with respect to our wildlife community. But You know, late 18, early 1900s were a time of diminishing diversity, I would say, certainly with respect to maybe the forest community, but also the wildlife community that depended upon it.
I wanted to just say something that I remember from reading the Hammerstroms, Frederick and Francis Hammerstrom, who were students of Aldo Leopold and who were, Leopold sent them to the Central Sands to do research on sharp-tailed grouse and prairie chickens. And the sharp-tailed grouse at the time that they got up there was, the sharp-tailed grouse were more, there were more sharp-tailed grouse than prairie chickens up in the Central Sands when they first arrived. And the suppression of fire and agriculture were slowly eliminating them. And now they're only up in the northern, as far as I know, the northern part of the state on a couple of state natural areas. But that's another big change that happened too.
Yeah, certainly the elimination of these massive wildfires as we carved the landscape up and actively started to suppress fires was impactful. But on the wildlife front, there were some wildlife species that benefited during the era of small farms. When you look at old aerial photos, and maybe that's something else I'd point out to listeners, you can look up old aerial photos of any area of interest. Just type in old aerial photos Wisconsin. As a Google novice, that's the type of search I tend to do. But and you'll pull up photos that were taken, aerial photos back in the 1930s and 40s, and you can see what was here. And it was a whole bunch of very small farms with fields 5 or 10 acres in size, surrounded by brushy fence rows and with corn shocks and oat shocks out ready to be loaded and harvested. So things like bobwhite, white quail, and initially prairie chickens did very well in that landscape. But of course, as we got into the middle 1900s, those small farms started to disappear and mechanized agriculture started to exert a heavier toll on at least the crop grounds. So things like quail, which were actually common in my area of Richland County in my youth, started to disappear. I don't know if either of you have seen a bobwhite recently, but it's been probably a decade since.
Shaking our head no.
Yeah. So again, it's this temporal view, you know, thinking about what's happened to the landscape and resultant effects on natural resources, wildlife, fisheries, aquatic systems, et cetera, in response to our impacts on the landscape. Another thing when we think about that era of mechanized agriculture is the increased reliance and throughout the 60s, 70s, but maybe accelerating into the 80s and 90s on pesticides, herbicides, genetically modified crops like Roundup Ready crops, the agricultural landscape far less suitable for wildlife really of any type. But certainly led to disappearance of things like bobwhite and reductions in wild ringneck pheasant populations, things like that. So maybe the take-home message is we've got our work cut out for us in the conservation realm. And maybe on the forestry front, Brandon, I know we talked about, you know, wildfire supporting some really important forest communities like oak forests, et cetera, but what sort of work do the Ho-Chunk staff do to maintain the diversity that was here initially?
Yeah, so in the Kickapoo area, a lot of work we do is one thing we did just complete on the 1,200 acres that the nation owns within the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. We just completed a full forest inventory of all the forested lands. So that data is going to be really vital for us in helping gear our management decisions. We can see what's there, ages of trees within each area, and kind of we get a good overall health indicator too. We are working hard on bringing fire back to the landscape as much as we can. We have a few areas that are readily burned. They're A lot of them are old ag field areas that were no longer within crop rotation, so we're managing those openings, having fire in them. We are reforesting some former ag areas too, where it seems like that area either should be or wants to be forested compared to being a little more of an open prairie type landscape. On the nation-owned lands within the KVR, we have taken everything out of traditional agriculture practices. We had still 150 acres that were leased for agricultural use. Those leases have not been renewed, and through the Conservation Reserve Program, we're working on getting those transition to native prairie. Those plantings will be going in this spring, actually, so that's something then we'll be monitoring those and managing those with prescribed fire as well. There's also too an emphasis in the Kickapoo area on different culturally significant plants and tree species. There's a lot of plant species in the area that we have a cultural forester who kind of has a list of all those species and a catalog of them, and kind of we dictate that into our management too, whether there's some areas that we need to avoid management on to protect those species, or certain practices like fire or opening up the tree canopy that would help those species out. A few barriers we run into as the deer population, you know, especially on some of those plant species. And then, of course, the exotic species, your invasive species are big too. That's something we do a lot of as invasive species control. So,
that's wow, wonderful. Very active. So it sounds like a lot of the work being done out there, and this is certainly true for VSN as well, is trying to address these issues and essentially replacing what nature had there in the first place, which seems like oftentimes what conservation is about.
We can all do a little bit by planting native vegetation and trying to go after invasives, even a little bit.
Yep, invasives, those exotics are always out there. So I thank you both for joining me in the studio here this morning. It's been wonderful. I think for those listening, again, there, if you're interested in this topic, there are a lot of great resources out there online.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.